Welcome to Little Atoms on Resonance 104.4 FM, a live talk show based around ideas of the Enlightenment.
Little Atoms is presented by Neil Denny, Padre Greedy, Richard Sanderson and Rebecca Watson, as well as regular mystery guest presenters.
Little Atoms makes no claims to balance. We actively promote science, freedom of expression, skepticism, and secular humanism. This means we can often end up talking about superstition, religious fundamentalism, censorship, and conspiracy theory.
Our guests bring ideas that are challenging, sometimes controversial, often polemical, but always interesting. Barbara's interviews have won 5 British Press Awards and a What the Papers Say Award. There are 2 published collections, Mostly Men and Demon Barber, both from Viking. She has also written books on Victorian naturalists and sex. Her first book was called How to Improve Your Man in Bed. Born in 1944, she read English at Oxford before working for Penthouse magazine for 7 years, then the Sunday Express, the Independent on Sunday, Vanity Fair and the Daily Telegraph, before joining the Observer in 1996. She now writes for the Sunday Times. Her memoir on education was recently turned into a film, scripted by Nick Hornby.
So, Lynn, most of the coverage about an education that people will have seen so far, and on your recent appearance on Desert Island Discs as well, is obviously focused around the sort of aspects that are in the film.
Right.
And include the coverage of Simon and your time at Oxford.
Yeah.
And we're not going to talk about any of that.
Oh, okay, that's all
been covered quite thoroughly.
Yeah.
What I would like to talk about in talking about an education is just really what's it like to have your life adapted for a film. So let's talk about how that process began.
It began, the film adaptation, because before I published the book, years before I published the book, I published just a short piece in Granta, which was the chapter that the film is based on about my affair with Conman when I was still a schoolgirl. And Nick Hornby's then girlfriend, now wife, Amanda Posey, approached me and said she wanted to buy film rights. And I thought, what a funny idea, you know. And she said she had a script writer in mind, but I didn't even know that she was Nick Hornby's girlfriend. So I thought, well, how can you have a script writer in mind? You know, I mean, it just seemed odd. But anyway, I sold the film rights. And then as film option, whatever it's called, as always happens with these things, years passed, you know, and occasionally I'd hear from Amanda that such and such a director is doing it or something. And also I'd said that Nick Hornby should send me all the drafts before they went out to sort of possible backers and things. Not that I had any right to change them, but just that I could look at them and comment on them. And that was quite fruitful, so that by the time the film was actually made, I really knew that film script pretty well, so it didn't come as a surprise, you know. I mean, it might have been odd if I'd just written the article and then seen the film sort of a few months later. It might have seemed like too big a gap, but I was used to the development of it. And it, of course, it moved a long way away from my little chapter into a proper film script by then, but I was very happy with it, and even more happy when I went to watch the filming and saw Carey Mulligan for the first time. I thought, crikey, she is really good, you know. And because I'd thought that you couldn't really get someone to act a 16-year-old, mm-hmm. because by definition you couldn't have an experienced actress, or it would be a sort of experienced child actress, mm-hmm. do you know what I mean? So it must have been difficult to cast, but my God, they came up with a winner, you know. I mean, she won everything.
So when you say you had input into the script, you were checking it. I mean, to what extent?
I didn't have any sort of control, but no, it was just.
But you don't have a credit or anything.
No, absolutely not. And if I'd said I don't like something, you know, he wouldn't necessarily take it out. But it meant that I could. There were just tiny things, like he'd said that my parents and I sat down to dinner. Well, we never called it dinner; it was tea, you know. And things like that. And also I put him onto the fact that we tended to chatter in French. It was our showing off thing at school that we said ça va and, you know, la vache and all the rest of it. And he put some of that in the script. But I mean, I didn't really have much input at all. But it just meant that I was familiar with the script, and I also saw it was quite educative reading it, because I saw why he'd made the changes that he had made, because it hadn't worked the time before, as it were.
So give us an example of that then. So something that would make the story work as a film, but not as it was.
Well, actually, the really funny one was that I asked him about, because, you know, there's a very sort of, to me, a bit sort of, not sentimental, but a bit cute scene at the beginning where she's carrying her cello home from school and the man offers her a lift and she gets in, or offers her cello a lift. And I said, why do you do all that with the cello? Because I never played a cello. That was totally made up. And he said, well, you looked a bit of a slag if you just jumped into the car. And I said, oh, OK, I get it. You know. Sure enough. But that was a good example. But also he had to make Simon a bit less sleazy and a bit more sympathetic. Attractive.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So if he was giving your cello a lift home, that would look a bit more gentlemanly.
Yes.
So let's talk a little bit then about, again, you said you went along and saw some of the filming.
Well, just one day I went, yeah.
Yeah, so what is that like?
Well, that was incredibly impressive, because I'd said I didn't want to see a scene with my parents or anything sort of too intimate. So I went to one of the school scenes, and they said it was at the Japanese school in Acton. I thought, that's a bit weird, you know, why is it at the Japanese school? But actually, it turned out that what is now the Japanese school is an old girls' school called Haberdasher's, which was actually the West London or equivalent of my school. We used to play lacrosse and have debating society meets. So it was the right sort of feel of school. And it was, well, they'd done the set, you know, they'd sort of got all these school photographs along the corridors and the girls' school uniform and everything. It was just the care and the detail that went into it was really impressive, I thought. And then when I saw the acting, and also the other wonderful actress in it is Olivia Williams, who plays the good school teacher who helps her. And so I saw a scene between the two of them, Kerry Mulligan and Olivia Williams, and thought, that really is good acting, you know. And I'm not a particularly good judge of acting, but I thought, well, I'm sure that's better than most, you know. Mm. And it was.
And again, another invented character in that she's doing there.
What, the good school teacher? Yeah. No, she does rather. Oh well, no, I suppose she doesn't actually. That might be something I sort of discussed with. I think I said that when I was kicked out of school, that one of the school teachers offered to give me private tuition, and that was what I meant. But yes, no, actually, you're completely right. And also because Nick had been a school teacher himself for quite a long time, I think he had some quite strong views on education, which he articulated more in the film than I ever had. Although I agreed with them, it was all about the fact that education is not what you learn at school.
Do you feel something, I mean, as someone you have known for interviewing other people, even though of course you always put yourself in the piece, was there something still quite odd about suddenly, you know, between writing the essay and then the book and the film, about everything being entirely about yourself?
Yes, it did. And actually, it went on terribly intensely, because I did some interviews. The book came out in, I think, June last year, the film in October. So I'd done some interviews about the book and sort of thought, oh, that's all done. And then Nick and Amanda said, can you do some interviews about the film? So it then sort of went on some more. But the film was coming out, I think, in October. So I thought, well, that'll be the end of it. But then the film was up for an Oscar, so there was a whole another round of interviews, and it just seemed to go on and on. And I did think, oh my God, I'm pretty tired of talking about myself. And the other sort of weird thing, which I might write about, is that my mother actually died in the September, but I couldn't sort of face talking about that in interviews. So I still people were asking me about my parents, and I was still talking about my parents as if they were both alive. For several months after actually my mother was dead, but I just didn't want to get into all that. But I did sort of think that, considering how I hate people lying in interviews, I was now doing it myself, you know, on a more or less regular basis. Not that actually I wasn't lying, because people didn't sort of specifically say, are your parents still alive? But I was talking about them in the present tense after my mother had died.
It makes a difference, though, because they're not particularly sympathetic characters as they come across in the story.
No, they're not. And that was the, in a way, the hard bit about doing publicity. Not thinking, oddly enough, my parents actually wouldn't mind, but by then they lived in a residential home, and I was very aware of all the sort of staff and other people in this home would be listening to it, so not wanting to dish too much dirt about my parents.
So okay, so just before we move on, because as I said, we don't really want to talk about that. What we really want to talk about is interviewing.
Yeah.
But having now been through that process of being the interviewee,
yeah,
in a number of times, has that changed your approach in any way? How, you just said, you know, you can now see why people in interviews might lie and things. Has it changed how you approach it in any way?
I don't think it's changed how I approach it, but it is sort of, well, it is a good learning experience to be interviewed. Having said that, actually, I wasn't such a novice at it as you might think, because my husband taught media studies.
Mm-hmm.
His students, those who were interested in journalism, used to come and interview me as a sort of exercise. But, yeah, no, it was a bit of a shock, especially as actually the first interview I did was one with The Telegraph. And at the time, I had a book reviewing contract with The Telegraph, so I thought, they're bound to be nice about me. And that was, whoa, that was really, really bitchy. And so I thought, God, I hope they're not all like that. And in fact, they weren't all. I mean, I just had an unusually nasty one first time round. You know?
So let's go back to me. I want to talk about how you basically became, you know, Demon Barber, the, you know, the terror of Fleet Street, and the, you know, the flair of various celebrities. Let's talk about how you, the early days on sort of Fleet Street, and how you actually began to become an interviewer.
Well, actually, I did interviews before that for Penthouse, mm-hmm, a bit, and that was a very good training in a way, because we had this section called, I think it was called Parameters of Sexuality or The Wilder Shores of Love, which was about people's sort of sexual kinks. And it was very good practice, because I would interview somebody and they would just be described as a foot fetishist or a dominatrix or a sex change man or whatever. So they were anonymous and they were keen to talk. I mean, I think they actually volunteered to be interviewed. Mm. So all I had to do was basically just sort of sit there and get it out of them. So it wasn't difficult, but...
So this would have been the early 70s?
Yes, absolutely, or even the late 60s, mm-hmm, slightly. And what that trained me, well, was never to be embarrassed, you know, and to work on the assumption that people wanted to tell me things rather than that they didn't want me to tell me things, and never to sort of show shock or disgust. So, you know, just keep it coming sort of thing. So that was quite good. Then I took some time off to have children, and then I went back to the Sunday Express to do a regular back-of-the-book celebrity interview called Things I Wish I'd Known at 18, which just meant to doing some random lots of celebs week after week after week. And it's one of those things where it's all one quote from them, so you don't actually, mm-hmm, intervene at all. But that was quite valuable because they all tended to say the same things, the emphasis had to be on thinking... picking up any minor difference, you know, from the other people, as it were. And I got particularly keen on capturing their real mode of speech rather than their sort of idiosyncrasies, mm-hmm, of speech. And that, again, was quite good. And then, I don't know, I just did more and more interviews. And then the big breakthrough was that the Sunday Express sent me to interview Bob Guccione, who I'd worked for all those years. And in those days, you were meant to write interviews as third-person pieces. But I thought, well, I've got to say I worked for him. It's crazy. I mean, you can't sort of understand, yeah, what we're talking about unless you have that background. And so I wrote in the first person, and it was very, very good. And, I mean, it's still very readable. And from that point on, they had to let me just write them as I wanted, you know.
Before we move on and talk more about that, I just wanted to step back a second, because, you know, you mentioned that you were for Penthouse. And from a distance, from where we are now, that seems like an interesting idea. And not because, you once worked for what would perhaps be considered a pornographic magazine. But just the very idea that in the 70s there were pornographic magazines that had writers working for them. So, you know,
yes.
So Playboy would be, you know, would be publishing stories, you know, centerfolds next to a short story by Huntress Thompson or Norman Mailer
we were imitators of Playboy, and that was the great Playboy formula, that, you know, you have it so that a man could buy it and sort of say, I'm buying this for the short story by Ernest Hemingway or the interview with Gore Vidal, you know, and we also operated on that basis. So the word content was quite high, you know, there was a lot of it, but also it was quite, it was pitched quite high, it wasn't stupid. And also, the other thing is, I mean, I suppose it was a porn magazine, but I mean, if you looked at it today, you wouldn't think it was a porn magazine.
No, sure, but those things do obviously change anyway. But what's interesting is that does seem, it seems unthinkable nowadays. If you look at, you know, that there are magazines in the supermarket, like the likes of, like, Nuts or something, which isn't a pornographic magazine, but it's probably, you know, as pornographic as Penthouse was at the time you were writing it. And the idea that they would have any literary content in there whatsoever is...
Oh, no, but you see, you're thinking in terms of the lads' mags, and there weren't lads. There weren't lads' mags.
No, sure, but that's the way it's gone.
Lads, isn't it?
They were gentlemen. They were discerning gentlemen.
You were a gentleman in your fine penthouse, you know, lying in your Eames armchair, flicking through this rather fine magazine with its interesting.
But by contrast, I think your description of the penthouse club.
Oh yes, that was miserable.
Absolutely abysmal. Yes. That was far from Eames chairs and, you know.
I know that was an absolute hellhole, and tragic for me because I had to take clients to lunch there, and all my authors who I've been used to taking to nice restaurants, I said, they had to take this horrible, horrible penthouse club. It was a really gloomy place, actually. Maybe at 3 o'clock in the morning it cheered up. It was terrible.
Or your expectations were just lowered so much by that point. But it's still a fantastically readable interview, and you've got this set of, I mean, obviously, you with Bob Guccione, you had, you know, access that no one else could really have had. But is there, it seems a bit of a truism to say, but is there an extent today, I mean, I've just been reading mostly men, and the willingness to talk in the interviews then seems
different.
Very different.
Well, yes, I mean, certainly in those days, particularly mostly men, a lot of which are from my Sunday Express days, so from the 80s, right, you certainly didn't have PRs around the place. And I mean, now you actually have PRs sort of insisting on sitting in on the interviews. And then, you know, I recently interviewed Liam Gallagher, and there was all this palaver. You can only talk about his clothes line, and you've only got 45 minutes. I mean, in fact, it was fine, you know, but that none of that happened in those days. But I think I am quite good at getting people keen to talk, as it were, and to get them on side with my line being sort of, I'm really trying to understand you and why you did this, and then they will sort of help, as it were.
So look, I'd like to know how you go about doing that then, because you know, you have a ferocious reputation, and we've never really sort of said why we do interviews as it is on air, I don't think, but, like, you know, we get criticised for not being particularly interrogative in our interviews, and this is done in a sort of direct opposition to the Jeremy Paxman type of interview, where he just shouts and barks at an MP who clams up, doesn't say anything, has probably been media trained to cope with that entire interview. And we feel that, you know, if you just get somebody to come in and talk, they will open up and they will say things. But then we only interview people we like, so our interviews are always nice.
Nice.
Now,
you're a long way from me.
Well, this is what I'm saying. But you do get people to talk. So as I said, Jeremy Paxman does, you know, that I think the Jeremy Paxman, John Humphrey's way of interviewing people makes them just clam up and not say anything. And it's more about people tuning to watch him abusing the Prime Minister or something. Whereas you do get people to open up.
Well, I do, but probably not politicians. I mean, that, you know, both Paxman and Humphreys are dealing with the most difficult form of interviews, these people who are actually sort of robot trained, not.
No, but then you say you're going into a room nowadays with a, I don't know, a film star with their publicist sat there, and as you just said, saying to you, you're not allowed to talk about this, 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 and this.
Yeah,
and, but yet you still manage to get people to say things that they. So how? I'm going to make notes.
I am genuinely interested in them. It's, at the point when I'm interviewing them, anyway, I mean, I will have prepared, and by then I'll be thinking, oh, it's really odd that he did this, that, and the other, and what happened to that second marriage, and, you know, what. I mean, I am really keen on their lives. What they sometimes perhaps don't appreciate is that tomorrow won't be at all, you know, but. Or once I've written the article, I would have forgotten them. But anyway. I think that's one thing. But, I mean, the cases you've mentioned, both the Hollywood circus has become impossible, I think, nowadays. And actually, I refuse to. I don't think actors are that interesting. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, if they're doing sort of 25 interviews in a morning and you're going to be sort of on a conveyor belt, I just don't want to do that. And politicians, it's a different problem, but... And also both those people, Paxman and Humphreys, are working for news programmes where the aim is to get something that advances the story, not sort of, you know, did you get on with your father, which is what I'd be asking, you know. So I think that's a fairly unfair comparison, actually.
You mentioned I can't remember which piece it was, but that you had a certain fondness for psychobabble.
Yes.
Is that something that you've actually, you know, read up and studied a bit in terms of trying to understand people? Psychology rather than psychobabble.
Well, I've got friends who are, a couple of friends who are therapists, and I'm always up for it, as it were. And if I can't remember the first time I heard the expression passive aggressive, I thought, oh, that's interesting, what does that mean, you know, and sort of asked somebody to explain it to me and thought, oh yes, that is quite a useful term, I can sort of get what passive, do you know what passive aggressive is?
No, you know, it's something that you hear all the time, and I've never really managed
never
to work out what
well,
it
you
is.
You see, the thing is, that, well, it's sort of martyred people, do you know what I mean, who don't complain, but they make you feel bad somehow. Mm. And so from that point of view, I'm quite keen on psychopathy.
Think of every Jewish mother joke, you know.
Yes, absolutely.
Don't mind me, I'll sit in the dark.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, where did I say that? Because in that, cause
it was,
actually it must be a very old article, because psychobabble at the time was, well, English people would always very contemptuously sort of say, oh, you're one of these people who go to a shrink and talk psychobabble, are you? You know, and I think that that's something that's changed in my lifetime, that people are a bit more prepared to talk about feelings and in a slightly more sophisticated way than just saying that my father was a wonderful man.
You're listening to Little Atoms, today with me, Neil Denny, and Padre Greedy, and we're talking to journalist Lynn Barber. So, Lynn, we've just been talking about you know, having a great ability to get people to open up and to, you know, to say things. Perhaps we can talk about some of the examples where those interviews haven't gone so well.
Right. Are you going to tell me what you had in mind?
No, but perhaps your opinion, yeah, exactly, on which when you think it's not, it hasn't worked. I mean, obviously, well, there are ones where, you know, where people, I mean, people obviously like the interviews where they're, you know, that where they're, you know, that you clearly don't seem to get on with the interviewee in the interview.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, there must still be occasions where you think it hasn't gone as well as it
might.
Yeah.
Well, the real disasters, I don't write up. I mean, that's the advantage of being a very experienced journalist. I mean, editors, trust me, I sort of say I interviewed. I mean, there was one with Dawn French where, I don't know why, she was so negative. She just sort of said yes, no, yes, no. And I said, it's not worth writing this up. So that's happened a few times. So the total disasters you wouldn't see anyway. Ones where I sort of feel I could do better. Well, there's quite a few of those. Or sometimes you've interviewed somebody. There was a recent one where I interviewed Lady Gaga. Thought I'd done quite well. but Catelyn Moran interviewed her for the Times absolutely brilliantly. And it helped in that case that they were more of an age and they went out on the town together at night, you know, which obviously I couldn't have done. So slight frustration there, you know, that somebody else has sort of gone in after me and done better. But other times, I just don't know. I mean, sometimes I sort of feel that I've sort of timed questions wrongly, so I've made them too wary too early on, or there's all sorts of interviews where I read them and think, yeah, I can see what I did wrong, and it probably was making a joke or something early on in the interview that then made them scared of me. But the other trouble with interviews is you don't actually know what potentially might have been there that you haven't got, you know. And so you can't be sure that you failed.
Well, I'm thinking of, you know, obviously there are examples of interviews where the interviewees haven't been happy, like the Chapman Brothers one, which you've sort of written about.
Yes, but that's a good piece.
Yeah, but that's what I mean. You would probably suggest that was a great interview.
That's a joyously good piece.
But then, you know, the other one that you famously write about is going to interview Nick Nolte, where you thought it had gone perfectly well, and then it turned out
he was
furious.
Yeah, but that's an example of one I never wrote, because he sort of aborted the whole exercise. But again, I still don't know what I did wrong. Graydon Carter just said I wasn't sort of sucky-uppy enough, you know. But I'll tell you an example recently of when Alexander McQueen died. I remembered that I'd interviewed him and looked it up. And that was an example of a bad interview, you know, where I hadn't sort of bonded, I hadn't got much out of him. I don't know whether I could have done it better at the time, or I don't know, but I mean, I just sort of thought, oh, that's disappointing. It's quite funny, because whenever somebody dies, I often see sort of bits, well, not always, but I often see an article of mine quoted in the obituaries or mentioned in the obituaries, so I look it up, and sometimes it's a very nice surprise, something I've forgotten writing, but I'm very pleased with. And then sometimes, as with Alexander McQueen, I sort of think, oh dear, that was a bad one, you know.
We were talking really about one element of media of publicists and control, and people having great control over their brand, I suppose, being very restricted. Is there, on the reverse of that, another problem for interviewers in that, you know, you take someone like, you know, Jordan Richman being the obvious example, where everything's out there, so you do an interview thinking, what more can I get?
What more is there? And yes, I mean, I've never interviewed Jordan actually, so. But yes, I mean, there is. I interviewed Kerry Katona, who's sort of slightly similar. And except with her, there's sort of some new crisis every week. So it's just a case of sort of what time you happen to, you know, get her, and whether she's in love, out of love, divorced, you know, getting married, having a baby, not having a baby, blah, blah, on a diet, not on a diet, on drugs, not on drugs. So they keep the action going, those sort of tabloid stars. But I agree, there are some people where you do feel every conceivable question has already been asked, and I don't quite see what there is for me to get. And I mean, that can sometimes be the case, I think, that you're not getting anything new. Mm. I've got an interview coming out next, I think it's next week or the week after, with Lily Allen. And I mean, she's somebody who talks so freely that you sort of think every inch of her life has sort of been exposed already. She's not going to say anything new. But because of my age, I was rather fixated on her parents, so I just went in big on that.
If you're talking to somebody like Lily Allen, who you know, will say anything, basically, do you ever feel a sort of... Do you not put things in? I mean, do you feel somehow sort of protective of the people that you're interviewing?
I'm aware that people, well, not in Lily Allen's case, but that people have children. I mean, I sort of think about that sometimes. And I don't want to, as it were, stir up marital disharmony when there isn't any or something. But so I'm a bit responsible about children, yeah. I mean, there's obviously an enormous gulf between us, a temperamental gulf. I mean, I think you said that you only find people you like interesting.
No. We only want to interview people we like, because I'm not interested in, you know, this is a radio show that we do at our spare time. You know, we're not getting paid for it, so it's, you know, so it only seems worthwhile to me to go and talk to people that I'm interested in. Therefore, right. the time when I interview somebody I don't like or I'm not interested in has just never happened. You know, that's never going to happen.
No, but so I'm often very interested in people I also very much dislike. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I would have, in a way, likability is a bit of a negative for
sure,
me.
Sure, sure.
And I am genuinely interested in people I also genuinely dislike. You know, I mean, I would have loved to have done Mrs. Thatcher, for instance. Mm. And actually, in a way, I mean, I can totally see why you do what you do, and now you've explained that. But, well, it's not what I do, is the answer.
Well, we're quickly running out of time, but just to finish off then, Lynn, this might be quite a vague question, but let's talk about what you think makes an interesting interview subject.
What I do, for me, because the other thing is, you know, other people can be interested in other interview subjects. I suppose I do like somebody where I think there's a bit of a sort of psychological hinterland that perhaps has not been explicated so far. And, I mean, I can tell you what I'm not interested in. I'm not interested remotely in sportsmen or... I'm not really interested. Well, I am interested in politicians, but I don't think there's any hope ever of getting a sort of truthful interview out of them. So I tend to keep off those. And then the trouble with actors is that they profess all sorts of daffy ideas which they don't really hold. And actually, the only thing they're really interested in is when their agent is going to phone them again and offer them another part. So those are ones I'm not interested in.
So that's pretty much everyone.
actually
be called upon to interview.
I was going to say, I do like doing pop singers who write their own lyrics and music. I do very much like doing contemporary artists because I think that they don't get enough publicity. And because
that's an interesting point.
Yeah, well,
I mean, I was going to bring it to the fact that you suddenly recently have been interviewing a lot of contemporary artists.
Well, not recently, I mean, 10 years.
Yeah, okay. But you say they don't get enough publicity.
Well, I don't think they do compared to what actors do.
Mm, sure, okay.
It probably has changed within this 10 years, and not thanks to me particularly, but thanks to the YBAs, you know, and especially Damien and Tracy, who sort of led the way in publicity. But actually, lots of artists are quite difficult to interview because the reason they're artists is because they don't trust words very much and they don't express themselves very well in words. And to find a way of interviewing that isn't sort of art bollocks, that has some attachment to reality, is a challenge.
That's the challenge.
I sort of think that I'm sort of, as it were, doing good in that I'm using my long, long, long experience as an interviewer to achieve something there instead of just sort of taking the froth off the cappuccino, as it were.
So that's it. So this, you know, if I may politely say, it's a late point in your career. That's what you feel, you're doing something that's useful there.
Yes, exactly. I mean, actually, I have interviewed artists as well earlier on. I did quite a lot of the Americans. I did Frank Stern, Rauschenberg, and actually Salvador Dali was one of the first interviews I ever did. And also because my husband was an artist, I was always quite interested in art. But then with the coming of the YBAs, that generation, they were so interesting. And whereas someone like Tracy can, you know, no problems with her, you can put a tape recorder on the table and walk away and she'll do it all herself, you know. But someone like Sarah Lucas, say, is quite difficult to interview, or Rachel Whitetreed, and I thought needed to be interviewed in a way, even if they didn't think that. I mean, I wanted to sort of give them publicity.
So you feel apart from you know, just simply giving publicity, is part of your role, you know, getting this stuff on record?
Exactly. And I mean, often I'm thinking of future biographers, as it were. I mean, someone like Rachel Whitetreed, I'm sure that there will be books about her after she's dead, and I hope that they will find some useful stuff in my interviews, you know.
At least two of those people you mentioned, you've written that you subsequently become friends with.
Tracy, yeah.
I mean, does that change how you would then approach?
Well, I interviewed her and then became friends with her, so, and I haven't...
But you might be called upon to interview her again at some point.
I might.
Or would you choose not to, now that you were friends?
No, I mean, I could. And if I went to the Venice Biennale with her, so I sort of interviewed her then. I mean, obviously it's not... I prefer an interview. It's more interesting for me if I don't know the person and I don't know anything about them. Well, I do know about them, but I don't have any sort of background on, or personal background with them. And it's quite embarrassing now because, again, because I'm so old, I get a lot of things where people say, oh, I can get my friend... I better not say anything, but to give you an interview. But you see, if they say my friend, you're sort of already compromised,
yeah,
because
sure.
Then you've got to like them, you know. and there have been some fairly sticky ones on that. But I don't generally... I mean, it's quite unusual for me to make friends with people. And in the case of Tracy, I mean, it was that I interviewed her not knowing, not even having met her, you know. And then we got on very well in the interview. And then she rang me up and said, you ought to meet my father. And, you know, went out another evening and met her father, and anyway, just sort of went on from there, and we are now genuinely friends.
You've been listening to Little Athens with me, Padraig Reedy, and Neil Denny, and we've been talking to Lynn Barber, who's an education is in shops now.
You've been listening to Little Adams. You can find details of upcoming guests on our website at littleadams.com. The Little Adams podcast is available on iTunes. Thanks for listening.